I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Welcome to Face to Face. This is a show about change and about what's next. It's a show that wants to ask questions, peel back the layers of our average everyday experience, and go beyond scratching the surface. We interview amazing people with incredible ideas and stories who have done wild, weird, and wonderful things. Remember that imagination shared creates collaboration, and collaboration creates community, and community inspires social change. I'm David Peck, and this is Face to Face.
Thanks for having me, David. Well, yes, by profession, I am a theologian, and that means that I get to teach graduate students classes in Christian theology. And then I also get to teach classes that bring together theology or Christian faith into conversation with the arts. So I have a course on the calling of artists, the vocation of artists, what does it mean to be an artist in the world. I have a course that looks at theologies of beauty. I have a course that looks at the intersection between theology and science fiction and other things like that. So I thoroughly enjoy my job. I love what I do, and I'm grateful that I get to do what I do. And I'm also married to a good woman named Phaedra, who is also a professional visual artist. And so I get to see up close, because she has her studio at home, and the kind of work that she makes. And we have two kids. Yeah, yes, yes, I am. I am. Yeah, but yeah. Well, thank you very much. I confess that I'm a latecomer to being a fan of you too. I was born and raised overseas in Central America, and so I think I was just off the radar of all cool things in popular culture and Western society. But eventually, I discovered them, and my first tape of theirs, cassette tape, was the Joshua Tree. And so, let's see, fall of 2014, I had this idea to bring together U2's frontman, Bono, and the author of the translation of the Bible, The Message, Eugene Peterson, who recently passed away, into conversation about some thing that they had in common, which was the Psalms. And long story, long, very complicated, strange story short, we finally found one afternoon on April of 19th, 2015, that they could both meet. And so we met in Eugene's home in Lakeside, Montana, a very small town in Montana near Glacier National Park. And U2 was at the moment practicing in Vancouver, actually rehearsing for the start of their tour, Songs of Experience. And so Bono flew out, and he and Eugene and his wife Jan had about an hour together conversation, and I had the two of them on conversation on camera, and it was a wonderful, wide-ranging conversation. But I focused on their thoughts about friendship, what it meant to be a friend in general. And Bono has said repeatedly throughout his life that he regards friendship as one of the two sacraments in his life, music being the other of them. And by that, I think he means that it is a vehicle for grace, for God's grace in his life. And that's how he describes his marriage, as this profound friendship with Allie. It's how he describes his relationship with his bandmates and a few others. So that was wonderful. And then the Psalms being another topic that Eugene has written about, and obviously Bono has sung about. And then a couple days later, when I was back in Houston, Texas, waiting for my bags, I get this email, which happens to be from somebody with the initials PDH, and I didn't know who that was, and eventually discovered that was Paul David Hewson, a.k.a. Bono, saying, "Hey, thanks so much for everything. Apologies that I didn't bring my A game. I'd like to make it up to you." So long story short, we ended up doing a second interview in New York City a few months later, and it was just a fantastic conversation with him, where he certainly brought his A game, very thoughtful, very intelligent reader of the Psalms. And then those two film material, they resulted in the short film. Yes, I did. Yes, I did. Well, because I'd actually had a short interview with Eugene when I was in Montana, where I asked him just a series of quick questions that I wanted simply one word answers. And so I thought I'd replicate it with Bono, and Bono found it immensely difficult. And so we did one take of that series of questions, and he just could not bring himself to give me short answers. So we did the whole thing a second time. And through the magic of editing, it looks like he was spot on. But he was spot on. It took a couple of tries to get to those simple answers. Oh. Right. Sure. Well, this may seem all too predictable, or maybe predictable for someone like myself, but I'm going to have to go with 40, and I still haven't found what I'm looking for. And maybe the predictability of my answer is that they relate to biblical texts, one being Psalm 40 and the other being St. Paul's language in one of his letters. And so, granted, I naturally gravitate in those directions, but I think to whatever extent I have, I guess, historically struggled with doubt in my life at some periods more substantially and more traumatically, I guess, than others, I find those two songs, they make good sense of my experience, of my own faith, and they provide language that name, you know, my reality and help me to live into it in a deeper way rather than escaping it. Sure. Right. Mm. I know. Sure. Right. Oh, to be sure, you know, I mean, Bono and his friends, you know, when they were teenagers, they had this, you know, mentor teacher figure who eventually became a chaplain for their band for 40 years, Jack Heaslip. From a very early, you know, time in their life, maybe being Irish, brings them into contact with religious subject matter naturally, as it were. But, you know, I think it's always been a very genuine thing for Bono. You know, certainly one of the things he talks about in that short film is how much honesty matters to him in his relationship to God, how much honesty matters to him in his work as an artist, how much honesty is something that causes him to be drawn to the Psalms. And I think any time we encounter an artist who, as best as they can, is honest with themselves, which is an extraordinarily difficult thing for any of us to do, and virtually impossible to do it on a consistent basis, as we're always turning some kind of blind eye to our own defects. But you see that he really does struggle to maintain or to retain a posture of honesty in his own life, in his marriage, in his relationship, in his work, you know, global work, philanthropic work, social justice work, but there in the crafting of songs, he is not only a master craftsman, he has definitely honed his craft. They are master craftsmen as musicians. Everything that they do in their concerts is so deeply, artfully, carefully done. All of those things, you know, come together to create this, you know, this amalgam of extraordinary art and in a sense, if I may hopscotch over to the language of beauty, one of the things that the Thomas Aquinas talks about, sort of this defining characteristic of beauty, is this capacity to be whole, that when we encounter something that is beautiful in the world, whether it's a person or an experience or a meal or a work of art, what we're encountering is wholeness. And that's the sense that everything about it holds together perfectly. There's nothing missing. And that can describe a perfect cup of tea, you know, tea and toast, or a five-course meal, or some very simple lyric, a limerick, or, you know, a gorgeous work of a poetry by T.S. Eliot. And I think that's what you encounter when you go to, a YouTube concert, is every aspect of it and the whole of it together is the sense that you're encountering this wholeness aspect of beauty. And if I can then marry it to something that is distinctively Augustinian, that is, when Augustine writes about beauty, he tends to emphasize the way in which beauty evokes desire in us, that awakens us in us a desire for that thing that we're encountering, and it awakens in us a desire to go beyond that thing, which is why you then get so much of this language of like transcendence, right? It's something that calls us beyond ourselves, whatever that may be. And I think that's what you have in an acute way in U2's music and concerts, is this encounter with beauty that causes people to come outside of it. It's an extrinsic, eccentric experience. You're outside of yourself. Yes, I think the answer is yes, and then more so. It's a desire for something truer, something better, you know, like the fulfillment of all that is good, something more beautiful, a beautiful life that is well lived, a just life. That's why so often justice and beauty are talked about together. Certainly there's a desire for God, and if somebody does not believe in God, they certainly believe that there is a way that the world ought to be. And the language of beauty provides them, you know, language, maybe a philosophical category to describe that human aspiration. And so, yes, and that's why I think, at least as a Christian theologian, that the arts and things that are beautifully made are for everyone. It is not for the few. It is not for the privileged. It is not for the elite. It is not for those who can afford it. It should be and ought to be a gift for everyone at every level, no matter what your cultural or social context may be, no matter how much money you have or where you live, that it is a gift. And again, as a theologian, I would say it is a gift that God gives to us and trusts to us in the small, ordinary, quotidian work of our home life, you know, our private lives, as well as in our public, you know, life and in the public square. Sure. Sure. Right. Well, I would say that the experience of a work of art, or the power that resides in a work of art, occurs at multiple levels. One level is going to be the experience of the person who's making it. When I write a play, there is the artfulness and the satisfying experience of making the work. It's what I bring to it. It's my intentions. It's my hopes. You know, when Childish Gambino, a.k.a. Danny Glover, makes, you know, writes the song This Is America. And again, for me as an American, there's something powerful about this song, but he has a very particular context that he brings to it. But then once the work is made, it exists in two forms, the musical form and then the video form. And that has another kind of power that exercises itself in the world. But then the third is the reception. You know, I, as an audience member, whoever I may be, whatever ethnic, racial, cultural, national background that I bring to it, I'm going to see myself in this, or I might not see myself. And so really you have all these different stages or contexts at which a work of art, is artful and exercises its power. And I think it's important that we attend to all those, because sometimes to ignore these different contexts is maybe to flatten the experience of art in a way that is unnecessary. Sure. Right. Sure. Oh, very much so. Sure. Wow. Sure. Sure. I mean, I guess I would say, and I'm writing a book that will come out in the summer, and one of the questions I ask is, if you were to open up the engine, you know, on each medium of art, and you were to look at the engine of poetry or the engine of architecture or the engine of dance, how would you describe it? What makes that, as it were, machine be uniquely itself? Like, what is the logic of the movement of bodies when you experience or spectate a ballet that might be different from dancing, let's say, swing dance? What's the difference between reading Shakespeare's Hamlet, watching a performance of it at the Globe Theater, as I had opportunity to do this last summer, and watching a movie? Well, you have three different media with three different logics that are inviting my sensory apparatus in a very different way. It's inviting my emotions and my imagination to participate in it in a distinct way. Or when I read the Chronicles of Narnia, it's my imagination that is generating all the images. When I see the movie, the filmmaker has created those images for me, and so it's affecting me in a categorically different way. It's a spectrum, but there are categorically different experiences, and I just say all the merrier, while at the same time I want to respect, you know, the logic and integrity of each medium of art, and to say they all have a distinct role to play in our human life and certainly in our society. Sure. Ha 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 ha. Right. Yeah. Well, I mean, I guess I would say, but part of the challenge when we talk about the arts is a linguistic terminology one. That the reason why we stumble over this art and craft is because it goes back to our Latin and Greek terms of techne and ars. And if you go back far enough, both those terms have a polyvalent sense to that, that you can say that the art of medicine or the art of war is harkening back to one sense of that term, which we would translate in terms of like skill or craft, and its ability to do something, or the art of government, the art of love, right? And then in history, eventually, perhaps maybe when you transition from the Renaissance into the modern era, you get this desire to extricate one aspect of art making into now what we call art for art's sake, which is really just a way of saying, I want to attend to the properties of copper that has been shaped in a certain form, and I'm not really interested in this as a vase, you know, a basin that holds water. I'm interested in how its physical properties make me think about power or strength in the world or delicacy in the world. And so, you know, at some point in history, you do get art acquiring this other sense, which is going to be different, say, from the liberal arts, which is this discipline within humanities. So I guess partly I would say we get lost in translation when we're talking to one another. On the other hand, if I can maybe riff off your magic thing, and I did watch that show on Netflix, Magic for Humans, and I thoroughly loved it because I think magic is so amazing. I think the whole explaining thing is a sore spot for a lot of artists. I think maybe there is a way that explaining can have a proper use or a proper context. When I go maybe see a performance of a Box Matthews' Passion, and I have taken a course in classical music, and somebody has explained to me the innards of music and classical music and how notes operate together and the theories and the practices, that does not diminish my enjoyment of the performance. It enhances it. When my wife and I go to an exhibit of contemporary art and she gives me a short history of contemporary art and why it is that artists do what they do with the medium, for me, it doesn't diminish. It actually deepens. And I feel like there is that sense of explaining. It's providing a kind of context that makes the work more intelligible, perhaps as a possibility for more meaningful engagement. That's a good thing. It's maybe the over-explaining or the explaining that becomes a substitute for the direct experience. That, I think, is a fair concern and is a problem, and it does tap into all of our utilitarian pragmatic tendencies in our North American society. That'd be great. Sure. You know, I wrote an essay once a number of years ago, essentially a theology of entertainment in defense of pleasure. And what I wanted to make was a case for art for the sake of entertainment, art for the sake of pleasure, art for the sense of that more simple, direct, if I can use this in a qualified sense, superficial, something that has one level of meaning, one level of experience, where I can eat a donut. It's not a complicated food group. And I ingest it and I have this burst of wowness, and that's it. Whereas a few years ago, my siblings and I, and our respective spouses, we made a 5-course Italian meal for my Italian mother. And that was a rich, multi-level, complex, demanding experience of food. And I guess, again, as a theologian, I want to say both of those belong in God's economy. Both of those should belong in our human communities. Both of those are ways for us to be fully human, that I can bless, as it were, those who are in the business of making simple things, so long as, I guess, they would not argue that only simple things matter. And conversely, I want to bless all those complex, difficult, demanding things in our lives and maybe works of art, and say those too have a place, so long as you don't argue that only those are the real ones. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. But you know, it doesn't have to be Michael Bay. It could be it could be the Great British Bake Off. Well, yes, partly because I actually think that's the essential fabric of our humanity is that we take pleasure in very difficult and very simple things, whether we are aware of it or not. You know, even those who make the Terrence Malick's of the world, if you were to go to his home or his ranch, you would not see him entertaining only difficult things. He probably enjoys a simple beer and a nice, you know, cut of ribs. It's not a complicated, you know, barbecue is not a complicated food group. And so if that is a way that we can faithfully characterize our human lives, then why not the arts be part of that fabric, that it has this range of the simple and superficial all the way to the difficult and the demanding, because they're both attending to the simple and the complex nature of our human lives. So to ignore one or the other, I think, is to rob us of some essential element of human flourishing. Oh, thank you. Well, I mean, I guess I would say the answer is yes, and then a little asterisk. Sometimes artists get nervous when we talk about the uses of the arts or the purpose of the art. And again, I think it's a little bit of a term confusion. When we say purpose, what do we really mean, right? Well, but then I would still want to argue, and I have these arguments with my art friends and my philosopher friends, that even art for art's sake is describing a purpose. That is, you're saying, if I were to observe over there human beings who are really happy, really flourishing, really doing everything they're supposed to do on planet Earth, fulfilling their calling, I would be able to say, oh, look, they do very simple and very complex things, and they enjoy literary fiction and they enjoy science fiction, you know, and it's all in the mix, and it all enables us to flourish. And so, you know, the television show Friday Night Lights, which of course hits near to home in my Texas heart, that was made because it was a good story, and the story was worth making. It was an end in itself. It didn't need to be anything more. It didn't need to accomplish the purposes of rectifying American football practices in high schools. It was just a good story that was well told. For me, however, it made me want to be a better husband. I found myself with this deep, acute, painful yearning to want to be a better husband. And there wasn't a one-to correlation. It was just being immersed in this world over several seasons generated a desire in me, in the same way that maybe Hosseini's novel, The Kite Runner, made me weep, it made me cry, it made me bawl, and it made me want to be a better friend. And I guess I want to say, can't those coexist? Can't they operate together, be part of this ecology? We can name them, we can articulate what they are distinctly, but be able to say, is not this world good for food and pleasing to the eye, to use the language of Genesis 1? Can't both be the ways in which we live in the world well? And I guess, again, as a theologian, I want to say, yes, yes, very much so. And the arts can do 1,000 different things, because human beings are in the business of doing 1,000 different things and have 1,000 different purposes. And the arts come along and are participating in this work of making culture, which is a way of making sense of our human lives. Sure. Right. Sure. Sure. Yeah, yeah, yeah. These things can become kind of latent gifts that they then birth at some other time. Right. I would say absolutely yes. And maybe the one qualification I would make to my argument, because I can imagine somebody pushing back on me and saying that's a nice romantic view of the world, but most human beings actually reject the invitation or the opportunity to experience the arts in this way. And so maybe to quote C.S. Lewis's essay, An Experiment in Criticism, it's not that we have good books and bad books per se, it's that we have good readers and bad readers. There are ways in which our disposition, the way that we are hardwired, the way that we attend to the world actually does result in a lesser or greater meaningful experience of the world. So if you come to a work of art only with a hard drive that wants to absorb and consume and take and to utilize, then yes, you will get very, very little, and you will result in a relatively malnourished human life, or maybe a two-dimensional rather than three-dimensional. And can you subsist on that to the day you die? Sure. You can subsist on lots of crummy foods until at some point. Yes, you can, but it's the difference between subsistence and flourishing. And I think flourishing does require a certain active, attentive, charitable, humble approach to people and to others. And again, that's easier said than done, and it requires a great deal of courage and honesty to maintain that posture, because the world is a painful place and we are wounded in a host of ways, and that wounding experiences causes us to shut down and to calcify and to shove down into places that we'd rather not attend to because it's so painful. And so, yes, again, as a pastor, I would say human beings are complicated and they're broken for any number of reasons. And so there's good work to be done by not just pastors and theologians, teachers and coaches and politicians and friends to come alongside one another and to enable our hearts and minds and bodies to open up so that we can more actively receive the good that certainly we would offer each other. And again, maybe I would say that God might offer to us through the arts. That'd be great. That'd be fun. Yes. Well, maybe I guess I would say partly it involves learning to be better listeners, better lookers, if I can use alliteration there. When we listen to others, when we listen to the world, when we look, when we smell, when we taste, when we touch, to really give it the time that it deserves. And I think maybe that's just kind of a fundamental principle of friendship and good relationship and good neighborliness, is that we actually give it the care-filled time that is required. And I think that's true of my marriage. It's true of my work as a father. It's work as a friend. Every time I rush or hurry by or try to cut corners, they suffer. And I suffer as a teacher. I suffer as a scholar. I suffer as a citizen when I try to take those shortcuts of one another. And so the same work that is required of loving my wife, loving my children, loving my friends, loving strangers, loving my students, is the same work that is involved in becoming a good maker of art and a good receiver of art. It's that art of listening, art of attending, art of learning, art of being humble enough to say, I don't know, will you teach me? The art of being humble enough to say that there's something else to be had, that there's something better or truer, or again, gooder, to use that term. I don't have to settle. I don't have to assume that I have figured it all out. And again, you know, these things happen with postures of humility. They happen when we choose to go experience something maybe rather different than ourselves, when we travel the world, when we read outside of our tradition. Those are the ways I think that we cultivate muscles that then turn into habits that then result in instincts. And that's an instinct of a way to be human in the world. And that takes a lot of time, and it takes a lot of care, and it takes a lot of work, and it takes a lot of good friends. So it's not easily come by, but it's not rocket science either. So there's hope for everybody. Sure. No, I'm not. Okay. That's fine. Yeah, sure. Sure. No, you know, right now, when I drive my daughter back and forth to school, we're listening on audio, C.S. Lewis's The Last Book in the Chronicles of Narnia, The Last Battle. And I have to say, you know, I've read it many times, but just listening to bits and pieces, I find myself absorbing that story told so well. I think it's Patrick Stewart who's telling the story. I hear the qualities of his voice, that the sensory kinetic qualities of his voice, and the way that he provides detail to the different characters. And I find that my heart, my emotions are stirred. And then I see the story played out in my imagination. And it does, the whole of it comes together. It's a metaphor for home, for our true home. And I think that's what all really good art does, whether it's simple or complex, is it's tapping into our senses and awakening our emotions and activating our imaginations in order to perceive some dimension of our true home. And that's why if our hearts truly are open, we just find ourselves having this happy, sad cry, because we know that our present lives are not our true home, but they can become foretastes and actual tastes, of that true home. Thank you. It'll be out in the summer. It's called Glimpses of the New Creation, Worship and the Formative Power of the Arts. And then I have another book that will be coming right after that. It's called Honest to God, The Psalms and the Life of Faith. So those are two books coming out soon. Thank you, David.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.